This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Randall Rickman for North Carolina Reading Service. We are reading Time Magazine. Welcome back. This edition is dated October 14th, 2019. We go right to the back of the magazine to include this week's interview feature, which this time is called 10 Questions. The interview subject is Bob Iger. Time says, the Disney CEO on consequential fun, firing humanely, and what he learned from scraping chewing gum off desks. Interview conducted by Belinda Luscombe. First question. There are many business leadership books. What does The Ride of a Lifetime offer that's new? Answer. Because I'm in the business of storytelling, and I had some good stories to tell, I thought I could write a book of stories that could convey advice to young people in a less dry, less business-like way. Question. You write that your hardest day was when an alligator killed 2-year-old Lane Graves at a Disney park while you were opening a new park in Shanghai. What lesson did you learn from that? Answer. That even though you're in a business that is essentially manufacturing fun, it doesn't mean that every day is going to be a happy day. Question. You also write that you took your father, who struggled with mental health and financial issues, to dinner, and you told him that in your eyes, he'd been a success. How did he respond? Answer. He did not express his understanding of it or his appreciation in words, but I could see that my words had meaning to him. Question. You have a legendary work ethic. Is that partly biology? Could all people develop that? Answer. I think it's a combination of biology, necessity, and just practice. Question. So we all have to scrape the chewing gum off 1,000 desks as you did one summer? Answer. That just taught me how to tolerate monotony. Anybody who's ever been in my life knows that I wake up happy, which basically makes it very, very difficult to live with me. Once I learned how to use that energy and enthusiasm to my advantage, it reinforced the whole dynamic, and I probably applied myself even more. Question. Is there any downside to that work ethic? You write of not wanting it to cost you another marriage. Answer. I think lives need balance for you and for the people around you. I'm sure there are times in my life where I failed. The impact on my marriage wasn't really from work ethic as much as pursuing opportunity. When people gave me opportunities, I seized them. I didn't purposely put my marriage on the line, but as a result, I made it difficult on my marriage. At least my last one, not my current one. Question. Risk-taking is a key leadership principle in the book. Yet one criticism that people level at Disney is that all its sequels and superhero movies feel iterative and not risky creatively. How would you address that? Answer. I can name numerous risks that we've taken just in the last few years. Black Panther, Coco, and a number of movies that are coming up, I find that criticism to be unfounded and preposterous. Question. One of the toughest parts of management is firing people. How do you do that in a humane fashion? Answer. You start with never really wanting to. When I have to, I try to be empathetic. I try to be to the point. I try to be transparent, meaning not to make excuses. I try to be generous in terms of explaining the reasons why, and I try to do so quickly. Question. Do you have any plans for after 2021 when you retire? Answer. Nope. I'm looking forward to waking up and not having a to-do list a mile-long final question. You've put your whole life, essentially, into a theme park company. Do you ever think, is that enough? Answer, here's what I think. There's never been a time when art and entertainment are as important as today. I think people are desperate for it, and I think that our place in the work in the world is both important and something that I'm extremely proud of. To be in this business at this company, at this point, at this time in the world, I don't look at what we do as frivolous. I don't look at what we do as small. I don't look at what we do as inconsequential. That was the entire interview conducted by Belinda Luscombe. Interview subject, Bob Iger, who does have a book mentioned in the interview. Iger is spelled I-G-E-R, Disney CEO. The title of the book discussed is The Ride of a Lifetime, Bob Iger. We now go to the front of the magazine, and this is the regular feature, For the Record, a one-page collection of small news items, each one illustrated by a two-color drawing, a caption or headline in bold, or a combination of the two. In the upper right corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Sergei Lavrov, Russian foreign minister, in a speech at the UN General Assembly on September 27th. The quotation from Russian foreign minister Sergei Lavrov, quote, "It is hard for the West to accept seeing its centuries-long dominance in world affairs diminishing," unquote. In the middle right margin of the page is a story illustrated by the statistic in red, 0.485. A caption explains, the Gini Index, a measure of income inequality for the U.S. in 2019, its highest level since tracking began. Gini is spelled G-I-N-I. In the lower right corner of the page is the feature within a feature, Bad Week, Good Week. At Bad Week, smelling. Officials investigated a mysterious rotten fish odor in two New Jersey cities. Under Good Week, tasting. Domino's Pizza in Australia posted a job for, quote, chief garlic bread taste tester, unquote. Running along the bottom of the page is a story illustrated by the statistic in red, 300,000. Caption explains, number of customers Dunkin' Donuts allegedly failed to properly warn after 2018 cyber attack per a lawsuit by New York State. 300,000. Caption goes on to say, the chain says it made sure customers were safe. In the lower left margin of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Prince Harry, announcing a lawsuit after a UK media company published a private letter of Meghan Markle's. And the quotation from Prince Harry, quote, I lost my mother, and now I watch my wife falling victim to the same powerful forces, unquote. In the upper left corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Pope Francis, unveiling a sculpture representing migrants and refugees at the Vatican on September 29th. The quotation from Pope Francis in red, quote, this means being a neighbor to all those who are mistreated and abandoned on the streets of our world. In the lower center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Hillary Clinton, promoting the Book of Gutsy Women, which she co-wrote with daughter Chelsea. Hillary Clinton on Good Morning America on October 1st, quote, I think the gutsiest thing I've ever done, well, personally, is make the decision to stay in my marriage, unquote. In the upper center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation in black and all caps and bold, Alfred, a protester in Hong Kong on October 1st, the 70th anniversary of China's Communist Party rule, the quotation from Hong Kong protester Alfred, quote, "Today is not a celebration for us in Hong Kong. Today we are mourning." And mourning, unquote, and mourning is spelled M-O-U-R-N-I-N-G. That's the entire content of the For the Record page. On the facing page is page one of the major opening section, The Brief. And the subsection leading off The Brief is called Opener. The subsection is World, where the headline is Johnson Rallies Base as Scandals Loom. Article by Billy Perigo. Dateline, Manchester, UK. A long-standing ovation greeted UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson as he appeared on stage in Manchester on the final day of the annual Conservative Party conference on October 2nd. It was his first speech to his party membership as Prime Minister, and he brought the gusto his right-wing base has come to expect, pledging to deliver Brexit, reinvigorate the national economy, and fire the leader of the opposition into orbit. But despite the adulation of loyal supporters here, Johnson's future looks less certain than ever. He not only looks increasingly unable to make good on his promise to deliver Brexit by the October 31st deadline, but also is in danger of losing political standing ahead of a seemingly inevitable early election because of two emerging scandals about his personal conduct while in positions of power. One dates from his time as Mayor of London in the early 2010s and involves his relationship with former model Jennifer Arcuri, who allegedly told friends she had a sexual affair with Johnson while he was married. Officials are investigating reports Arcuri improperly received government money, including two grants totaling £11,500, parenthetically $14,000. £11,500 from a public fund managed by Johnson at the time. Both he and Arcuri deny any impropriety. The second scandal stems from new allegations published on the eve of the conference that in 1999, when he was editor of Spectator magazine, Johnson groped the upper thigh of journalist Charlotte Edwards under a table at a dinner. Johnson's office said the incident never happened, but his health minister said he felt Edwards was, quote, trustworthy, unquote. The allegation has also renewed attention on the Prime Minister's past indiscretions, which include a number of extramarital affairs and at least one child born out of wedlock. On the conference floor, Johnson's party faithful were happy to ignore the new allegations so long as he could deliver Brexit. Quote, "My honest view is, who cares?" unquote, responded one delegate. Quote, "The only reason it's coming up now is people who are trying to stop Boris Johnson in his tracks," unquote. Established members of the party also smelled a conspiracy. Quote, "He's under attack from all sides from people who wish to prevent Brexit," unquote. Jeffrey Van Orden, a senior conservative lawmaker in the European Parliament, told Time, quote, "The sources of these accusations are people who want to destabilize Boris's government and distract people from his main task," unquote. In his speech, Johnson suggested dark machinations were at work. Quote, people are beginning to suspect that there are forces in their country that don't want Brexit delivered at all, unquote, he told the crowd, to a thunderous response. Quote, within the Conservative Party, it's clear he's their champion, unquote, says Tim Bale, professor of politics at Queen Mary University of London. Quote, partly because he's been offering them everything they've ever wanted on Brexit. In spite of all the allegations about his personal life, he still remains very popular. In the same way they do with Trump, people dismiss the sexual impropriety allegations as either unbelievable or unimportant, unquote. Yet, polls show Johnson's popularity in the country as a whole is waning. A majority, 55%, is now dissatisfied with him as prime minister, up 17 points from July, according to a poll by Ipsos Mori, published on September 30th. Women, in particular, are turning against him. According to a YouGov poll published on September 27th, 47% think he is, quote, dislikable, unquote, a 7-point increase from late August. The more recent allegations may drive that figure even higher. Such a change will matter if, as widely expected, a general election takes place in the UK this winter. Although Johnson pledged on stage to ensure Brexit happens on October 31st, quote, come what may, unquote, he is legally unable to do so unless he manages to strike a new last-minute deal with European leaders. If he fails, and Parliament forces him to seek another extension to the deadline, an election may follow that Johnson's advisers believe he could win by casting himself as the victim of a cabal that wishes to stop Brexit at all costs. His diehard supporters may demand a greater sacrifice. 50% of Conservative voters would prefer he break the law to force a no-deal Brexit rather than ask for a further delay, according to a YouGov poll from September 9th. That might leave him in a jail cell, or worse, said Dominic Grieve. A lawmaker, Johnson expelled from the parliamentary party for rebelling against the government. Quote, ultimately, the Queen would dismiss him. She's not going to have a prime minister who breaks the law. This is fundamental. Unquote. Just 2 months into his premiership, Johnson's grip on the keys to 10 Downing Street seems more tenuous than ever. But in his conference speech, he betrayed barely a hint of concern, tossing out jokes and red meat slogans to rapturous applause. Yet, for all the bellicose rhetoric, there were hints of conciliation, too. Quote, this is not an anti-European party, and it is not an anti-European country, unquote, he told the crowd. Quote, we love Europe. We are European, unquote. In Johnson's whole speech, they were virtually the only sentences greeted by silence. Entire article by Billy Perigo. On the facing page, feature called The Bulletin, where the headline is, as Forever 21 files for bankruptcy, the retail apocalypse marches on. Article by Alejandro de la Garza. American mall behemoth Forever 21 achieved massive success in the 2000s by selling inexpensive variations on the latest styles, and now its decline is a window into a different kind of trend. The chain, founded in 1984 by a couple who had emigrated to the U.S. from South Korea, declared Chapter 11 bankruptcy on September 29th. Forever 21 has said it will terminate operations in 40 countries and close up to 350 stores worldwide, and that up to 178 of its 549 U.S. outlets will be liquidated. Here, Alejandro de la Garza lists three topics. First topic, out of style. Industry analysts see the store closings as a sign of shifting tastes on both sides of Forever 21's business model. Some consumers have become less inclined toward the cheap, disposable clothing for which the retailer is known, turning instead to brands that claim more sustainable or ethical business models. Others, among Forever 21's young clientele, are opting for more nimble brands like Fashion Nova and Shine, which lean even harder on trendiness. Quote, there's a bit of a battle emerging between the rise of conscious consumption and the rise of ultra-fast fashion, unquote, explains Elizabeth Klein, author of The Conscious Closet. Second topic, changing rooms. From a business perspective, Forever 21's crisis may have been caused more by management mistakes than consumer forces. The brand got in trouble by moving into over-large spaces abandoned by former retail anchors like Sears, and into categories in which it lacked expertise, like consumer electronics, argues Mark Cohen, a professor of retail studies at Columbia University. The company also generated additional burdens with aggressive international ventures. Quote, mindless expansion has been Forever 21's downfall, unquote, Cohen says. Final topic, not buying it. Facing declining foot traffic and rising online competition, retailers from Payless Shoe Source to Toys R Us to Barney's New York have also filed for bankruptcy in recent years. In what's been called the, quote, retail apocalypse, unquote, individual workers have been hit the hardest. Forever 21's announcement has put the future of its more than 30,000 employees at risk. And they won't be the last. Consultants at the firm CoreSight Research have projected that 12,000 American brick-and-mortar stores could close before the end of 2019. Entire article by Alejandro de la Garza. Also sharing this page, in the margin, is regular feature news ticker, collection of three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, major floods devastate India. Unusually late monsoon rains caused devastating floods in northern India, leading to the deaths of at least 100 people, officials said on September 30th. The monsoon, the most severe since 1994, left large areas underwater, forcing people to use lifeboats to escape their homes. Middle item, Trump administration cuts refugee quota. President Trump on September 26th limited the number of refugees who will be allowed to settle in the U.S. in the coming year to 18,000, down from 30,000 last year, prompting condemnation from human rights advocates. The Obama administration allowed up to 110,000 refugees to resettle in the U.S. in 2017. Bottom item, Morocco judgment sparks outrage. A Morocco judge on September 30th sentenced journalist Hajar Razouni and her fiancé to a year in prison after they were found guilty of premarital sex and getting an abortion. They deny an abortion happened. And rights groups see the case, which sparked protests, as part of a crackdown on critical coverage of the government. That was news ticker. We now come to the milestones page. The lead item is under Died Jesse Norman, Opera Goddess, observance by Denise Graves. Time says Graves is an operatic mezzo-soprano who appears this season in the Metropolitan Opera's Porgy and Bess. She writes, "When I was a student at the New England Conservatory, Jesse Norman gave a recital in Boston, and afterward I stood in line with all the other admirers to tell her how much she had impacted me. I said to her, 'Ms. Norman, what could I possibly say to you that you haven't already heard 1,000 times? And she said, 'My dear, I'm sure you can think of something.'" On stage, Norman, who died on September 30th at 74, portrayed a lot of mythological characters and Greek goddesses, and for me, coming up in the early 80s, she really was an absolute goddess. She was a tremendous source of pride for a young African-American singer. When we look through the lens of classical music, we don't often see someone with brown skin, but to see someone like her, who was a master at what she did, who carried herself with such majesty, you'd be encouraged to say to yourself, if she can do that, then that's something that I can aspire toward. And then the voice. The voice was one in a million, rich and colorful, with so much texture from the bottom to the top. It washed over you, but it also felt like an embrace. She possessed an incredible instrument, and she was a scholar in her approach to singing. She was a real grande dame in every sense of the word and called us to be our best selves as human beings and as artists. Just because of who she was, she made us rise in her presence. Observance by Denise Graves on Jesse Norman. This item is accompanied by an almost full-length, full-color photograph of Jesse Norman. Caption says, "Norman in Ariadne of Naxos at the Metropolitan Opera in 1993. Under Died, Jacques Chirac, Francis Stalwart. Observance by Vivian Walt. Jacques Chirac, who died on September 26th at 86, towered over French politics for nearly 4 decades, as mayor of Paris, prime minister, and finally president for 12 years. To some, he seemed to lack strong views or convictions, but to others, he now seems to encapsulate a less troubled time in France. Quote, "He had a really deep understanding of the people, and at the same time, he thought that France had something special to say to the world," unquote, says Dominique de Villepin, a former prime minister who served as Chirac's chief of staff. Indeed, Chirac was France's first leader to acknowledge its role in the Holocaust. He was also the first world leader to rush to New York after 9/11 to show unity. Quote, "He felt very strongly the solidarity with the American people," unquote, de Villepin says. Quote, "He understood very deeply how the world was going to change," unquote. But Chirac broke with the U.S. in 2003 over its invasion of Iraq, a schism that took years to heal. In his beloved France, something else will likely shape his legacy, his flair for connection. Quote, He had huge pleasure in meeting people," unquote, de Villepin says. Quote, "He was really in politics because he loved it," unquote. Observance by Vivian Walt, Jacques Chirac. This is accompanied by a full-length, candid photograph. Caption says, "Chirac in Paris in 1996. Under Died, U.S. diplomat Joseph Wilson, who in 2003 publicly countered the George W. Bush administration's claims that Iraq was attempting to acquire nuclear weapons. Joseph Wilson died on September 27th at 69. Under announced that nuclear disarmament talks will resume between the U.S. and North Korean officials, announced by officials in both countries on October 1st, shortly before North Korea launched a missile test. Under resigned, GOP Congressman Chris Collins of New York on September 30th, a day before pleading guilty to federal securities fraud charges. Under convicted, former Dallas police officer Amber Geiger, convicted of murder on October 1st. In September 2018, Geiger fatally shot her neighbor, Balsam Jean, who was black and unarmed, shot after she mistakenly went into his apartment instead of her own. Under pulled, heartburn drug Zantac from shelves in several major pharmacy chains after the FDA said earlier in September it had detected small amounts of a possibly cancer-causing chemical in the medication. The company that makes Zantac says it meets all safety requirements. Under tested, a new Facebook policy that would hide the number of likes on posts with Australian users on September 27th. That was the entire contents of the For the Record page. On the facing page, still in the brief, this subsection is news, and the particular section is Good Question, where the headline is, Will a law permitting player payments ruin college sports? Article by Sean Gregory. On September 30th, after California Governor Gavin Newsom signed into law SB 206, a bill that allows the state's college athletes to profit from their names, images, and likenesses, and to sign endorsement deals, despite NCAA rules forbidding them, state lawmakers across America followed California's lead. The Democratic leader of Florida's House filed a bill mimicking California's first-of-its-kind law, which goes into effect in 2023. So did a legislator in Illinois. Not even 5 hours after the California news broke, two Pennsylvania House members, Dan Miller and Ed Gainey, circulated a, quote, Fair Pay to Play Act, quote, unquote, of their own. Quote, The future is starting in California, unquote, Miller says, quote, It's time to roll, unquote. So far, the NCAA is refusing to embrace this sea change. The organization argues that a patchwork of state laws will bring chaos to college sports and, quote, make unattainable the goal of providing a fair and level playing field, unquote. But inequality is already rampant in college sports. Football powers such as Alabama, Clemson and Georgia consistently sit atop coaches' polls and have resources like gleaming facilities and reputations for churning out pros that the lower rungs of Division I can't offer. If Alabama starts losing recruits to UCLA because players can sign endorsements in California, Alabama can change its state laws to keep up. College sports officials fear a player payment movement will spread, but schools and their athletics programs aren't actually likely to be hurt by such laws. First, under the California model, they aren't on the hook for compensation. Third parties, whether sneaker companies or local car dealerships, are the ones making payments. Second, allowing players to profit shouldn't damage the supposed purity of, quote, amateur, unquote, college athletics and turn off fans. Critics made similar arguments about the Olympics when more professionals began competing in the 1980s. But Michael Phelps and Usain Bolt seem to do okay. The games attract multi-billion dollar TV deals. Plus, college sports will always be a fun spectacle. The 11 a.m. tailgate sausage and beer will still taste good, even if the starting linebacker is a Tuscaloosa Toyota pitchman. Most important, these laws promote basic fairness, and not just for future NFL stars. Female athletes, for example, will be able to promote themselves and secure sponsorships while thriving in college, a key allowance as professional opportunities remain sparse in women's sports. And for the many athletes from disadvantaged backgrounds who don't end up making the NFL or NBA, their monetary value soars while they compete in college. Why shouldn't they seize it? Quote, California gives us hope that there is a level of justice we can get to, unquote, says Ganey, the Pennsylvania lawmaker co-sponsoring a bill. Quote, at the same time, college athletes are helping schools make millions. Let them help themselves. Let them make some money. Unquote. Entire article by Sean Gregory. We go now to the risk report, where the headline is, if only the Japan-South Korea trade war were about trade. Article by Ian Bremmer. The U.S.-China trade war is inflicting the most damage to the global economy, but it's the trade war, the trade spat between Japan and South Korea, that signals the larger troubles ahead for the world. South Korea's Supreme Court ruled in late 2018 that a number of Japanese companies must compensate a group of South Koreans or their descendants, South Koreans who were forced to work for them during Japan's occupation of the Korean Peninsula from 1910 to 1945. Japan argues that all such claims were settled by a 1965 treaty between the two sides. South Korea's Supreme Court disagrees, and President Moon Jae-in's administration insists that it has no authority to tell the country's independent judiciary to reverse the ruling. Frustrated with the proceedings and determined to put pressure on Moon's government to intervene in some way, Japan strengthened restrictions on several high-tech exports to South Korea in July and downgraded South Korea's status as a trusted trading partner in August. South Korea returned the trade fire, and suddenly two of Asia's largest economies were locked in a trade war. There is not much love lost between Japan and South Korea. Nearly 75 years after World War II ended, the two sides continue to argue over the issue of how much, how often, and in what form Japan should appropriately atone for its past transgressions. But what makes this recent round of historical finger-pointing worrisome is the speed with which trade was roped into this fight and how effective it has been in satisfying public outcry. Boycotts have already erupted. In South Korea, sales of Japanese beer and cars have tumbled precipitously. At the end of the summer, nearly 7 in 10 Japanese supported the tech trade restrictions slapped on Seoul. More than half of South Koreans approved of how Moon's administration was dealing with Japan. With numbers like these, it's unlikely that either Moon or Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe will make the first move toward reconciliation, parenthetically, as each is demanding of the other. On October 1st, Seoul accused Tokyo of sitting on the approval of a Japanese firm's request to send a shipment of liquid hydrogen fluoride, critical in building semiconductors, to South Korea, fueling worries over tech supply chains. In August, the trade war even spilled over into security, as Seoul announced that it would not renew an intelligence-sharing pact with Tokyo, to the dismay of the U.S. Not that Washington can say much about it these days. After all, it was the U.S. that decided to bundle a host of other disputes it had with the Chinese into a trade fight, not to mention threatening to increase tariffs on Mexico unless it beefed up border security, setting a troubling precedent for those once wary of doing the same. Trade has become an acceptable weapon in a country's diplomatic arsenal. In August, French President Emmanuel Macron threatened to upend the EU-Mercosur trade agreement over Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro's refusal to deal with fires on the Amazon rainforest. With the U.S. decision to stop playing a global leadership role and mediating disputes, the world will face more grievances between countries that royal economies and trade. Entire article by Ian Bremmer. Going ahead, and now this section, which is The View, has a subsection called World, where the headline is The Resistance. Article by Karim Sajjadpour. Iran's president arrived in New York City in September and left, as usual, without meeting the American one. Both Hassan Rouhani and Donald Trump professed an appetite for sitting down and talking over the ever more treacherous rift between their nations. But, as Rouhani has pointed out in private, Iran's top elected official, quote, has no authority in foreign policy, unquote. That authority, and nearly every other strand of power in the Islamic Republic, resides with the elderly cleric who remained 6,000 miles away in the country he has not left for decades. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, 80 years of age, disabled by a saboteur's bomb blast and lit by a religious righteous certainty, holds the title of Supreme Leader of Iran. But he has quietly emerged as the most powerful person in the Middle East, with uniformed military fighting in Syria and loyal proxies dominant in Lebanon, Yemen, and, parenthetically, despite a U.S. investment of $1 trillion and thousands of lives, Iraq. Since the spring, behind a thin veil of denials, he has also presided over an audacious and escalating campaign to raise uncertainty and global oil prices, shooting down a $176 million U.S. drone, blowing holes in tankers, and bombing the heart of Saudi Arabia's oil production, all without drawing a U.S. military response. Khamenei, who has confounded every U.S. president he has faced since coming to power 30 years ago, harbors a particular animus for Trump. In June, he told the Prime Minister of Japan, who had come bearing a message from the White House, quote, I do not consider Trump as a person worth exchanging any message with, unquote. A detonation on the hull of a Japanese oil tanker the same day might have been an exclamation point. Perhaps no other foreign leader is working harder to put Trump out of office than Khamenei, and perhaps no other foreign leader differs in more ways. Trump, thrice married and irreligious, has lived a life of opulence and publicity. The deeply devout Khamenei has been married for over 55 years, and he openly disdains pomp and materialism. Trump, operating on impulse, exhibits no organizing principles, Khamenei has shown a lifelong commitment to his resistance against, quote, global arrogance, unquote. His moniker for American imperialism is both ideology and strategic doctrine for the theocracy. When Trump unilaterally withdrew the U.S. from the 2015 deal that had significantly curtailed Iran's nuclear program, the move validated Khamenei's view of the U.S. as, quote, deceitful, untrustworthy, and backstabbing, unquote. The sanctions Trump then imposed have further debilitated Iran's economy, sending it to 50% inflation. But they seemingly stiffened Khamenei's resolve. Quote, resistance, unquote, Khamenei said in a recent speech that included the word 70 times. Quote, unlike surrender, leads to the retreat of the enemy, unquote. In Trump, Iran has an enemy who does not want to fight. After an Iranian missile shot down that massive U.S. drone in June, Trump at the last minute retracted his own order for military retaliation. 2 days later, he thanked Iran for not shooting down a manned flight. Quote, that's something we really appreciate, unquote. The vacillation seems to have only increased Khamenei's appetite for risk. And on September 14th, Saudi Arabia's largest oil facility was crippled by a missile and drone attack. Iran denied involvement, but the game unfolding now is one Khamenei knows well. For years, he has carefully calibrated Iran's reaction to U.S. pressure. An insufficient response might project weakness and invite more pressure. An excessive response, on the other hand, could trigger a serious U.S. retaliation and risk outright war. It's a situation made even less predictable by two qualities the leaders do share. Each harbors an appetite for conspiracy theories and a profound sense of victimization. Khamenei is a geriatric cleric ruling over an increasingly secular population whose median age is 30. Aside from Syria's Bashar Assad, he has no reliable friends in the world. And he goes to bed every night and wakes up every morning believing that the U.S. government is actively trying to overthrow him. This paranoia, frequently reflected in official state media, which Khamenei controls, also is driven by political expediency. Mohammad Khatami, the reformist cleric who was Iran's president for two terms, 1997 to 2005, told me in a private meeting in Oslo in 2008 that when he was in office, Khamenei used to tell him that Iran, quote, needs enmity with the United States. The revolution needs enmity with the United States, unquote. Despite its distance and a military budget less than 3% of that of the U.S., Iran has loomed large in American domestic politics. The Iran hostage crisis ended Jimmy Carter's presidency. Iran-Contra tainted Ronald Reagan's presidency. Iranian machinations in post-Saddam Iraq exhausted George W. Bush's presidency. And the Iran nuclear program and negotiations engrossed the Obama presidency. Trump inherited from Obama an Iran that resembled the late-stage USSR, powerful beyond its borders, but hemorrhaging billions of dollars in foreign entanglements and mired by internal economic malaise and ideological fatigue. But instead of marshaling global unity against Tehran's malign activities, Trump abandoned the nuclear agreement the UN reported Iran had been adhering to. To this day, senior U.S. government officials confuse Khamenei with his charismatic predecessor, Grand Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the founder of the Islamic Republic. Although Khomeini died 30 years ago, his sinister daily presence on American TV sets through the 444-day hostage crisis left a lasting impression. Quote, "These economic sanctions are just a part of the U.S. government's total effort to change the behavior of the Ayatollah Khomeini," unquote, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said in a November 2018 briefing. Quote, "The assets of Ayatollah Khomeini and his office," unquote, President Trump followed up in June 2019, quote, "will not be spared from the sanctions," unquote. The confusion, like so much the U.S. does, may serve Khamenei. He prefers to obscure his vast power behind the Islamic Republic's Byzantine array of institutions. For our listener right now, I am going to spell the two versions, the two different names. The founder of the Islamic Republic, who died 30 years ago, Ayatollah Khomeini, that is spelled K-H-O-M-E-I-N-I, Khomeini. The current supreme leader of Iran, Khomeini, is spelled K-H-A-M-E-N-E-I, Khomeini. Very difficult to pronounce them differently, the way they are spelled. Khomeini, the supreme leader, prefers to obscure his vast power behind the Islamic Republic's Byzantine array of institutions. The Assembly of Experts, Guardian Council, Expediency Council, and Revolutionary Guards evoke a Game of Thrones-style drama. But in reality, they are all led by individuals handpicked by Khamenei or unfailingly loyal to him. They serve to buttress rather than check his authority. Khamenei is a reader. He has frequently said Victor Hugo's Les Miserables is the greatest novel ever written, and his Instagram feed shows him smiling as he reads a Persian translation of Fire and Fury, Michael Wolff's unflattering account of Trump's first year in office. And though it's unknown whether he's read The Prince, he displays a Machiavellian genius in manipulating what Iranians call, quote, the system, unquote. Khamenei's slightest feat, assuring that he has power without accountability. While Iran's elected presidents have accountability without power. Iran makes a great show of its highly manipulated presidential elections, and their importance to the public became clear when the 2009 ballot was stolen. Millions took to the streets in what became known as the Green Movement, brutally quashed by the leader's internal militia, the Basiji. Marring the ballot was a dangerous miscalculation by Khamenei, and perhaps an unnecessary one. No matter the challenge brought by a president, the economic challenge of Hashemi Rafsanjani, 1989 to 1997, the democratic challenge of Khatami, the populist challenge of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, 2005 to 2013, or the pragmatic one of Rouhani, 2013 to present, Khamenei emasculated each. In more than two decades researching Iran, both in Tehran and the U.S., I have learned the most important indicator of the regime's behavior is in the speeches of the supreme leader. Khamenei projects a life of piety and service. He hasn't left the nation since 1989, and apart from a small, trusted coterie of advisors, is largely inaccessible. His modest official residence in working-class central Tehran is hidden from the public, and his clothing usually consists of dull robes and cheap slippers. Visitors to Khamenei's abode curry favor with him by publicly recounting its simple decor and plain dinner menu, often bread, cheese, and eggs. Among his two daughters and four sons, all of whom became clerics, only one, Mojapa, has a public profile, and in contrast to Arab first ladies, whose spendthrift ways have fueled popular anger, Mrs. Khamenei has never been seen in photographs. Still, the facade was pierced by a 2013 Reuters investigative report that revealed Khamenei controls a $95 billion financial conglomerate, which he uses as he wishes. The conglomerate was built on the seizure of property of Iranians, many of them religious minorities. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time. We hope you've enjoyed it, learned something from it, and please be sure to listen next time. This is your reader, Randall Rickman, for and from North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Our number again, 919-832-5138. This is your reader, Randall Rickman, thanking you once again and hoping you will join us next time for your time.